Good morning, everyone. It's lovely to see you and to be with you here in person. Just as Anthea said, totally was not expecting that this time last week. So it's really lovely to be here. Let me start with a bit of a confession. As you may well know, in Paul's first letter to Timothy, Paul urges his apprentice to pray for kings and all those in authority. And this is one of those commandments that, to my shame, I had never taken particularly seriously until last year. Last year, I began to pray for my politicians in earnest. Never had I felt such sympathy for politicians and their advisors. Wrenched from my usual lack of interest in politics and my easy cynicism, I found myself engaging far more deeply in the dilemmas of my leaders and conscious of the sheer energy it must require to keep fronting up to a job where no decision you make comes without a cost of some kind. That leaders stir powerful and conflicting emotions in the people they lead is, of course, nothing new. Leaders inspire in us extremes, running all the way from adulation on the one hand to hatred and contempt on the other. What people may find surprising, however, is just how powerfully these emotions make their presence felt in the Bible. The Bible's view of human leadership, and let's add immediately people's attitudes towards their leaders, is remarkably nuanced. In the first part of this sermon, therefore, I want to look at the Old Testament's famously ambivalent attitude towards kingship as a political institution in ancient Israel. In part two, we'll then turn to look at kingship as an institution provided for in the book of Deuteronomy. Then in part three, we're going to be looking at kingship as an office both fulfilled and transformed by Jesus. And in each part of the sermon, we'll try to retain a dual focus. On the one hand, I'm going to be asking the question, what is God's vision for good human leadership? And on the other, I'll be asking, what do our aspirations for and anxieties about our human leaders reveal about us? Well, let's dive in. Part one, kingship in Israel. Well, as I just said, the Bible's attitude towards Israel's kings is profoundly ambivalent. One would expect the Bible to assess the reigns of different kings individually and differently. And this is, of course, the case. But the ambivalence of the Bible extends further to what we might call kingship as an institution in Israel's life, above and beyond the assessment of individual Israelite kings. On the one hand, it's possible to find ringing endorsement of the king as a key aspect of God's good provision for his people. So consider, for example, this verse from the book of Proverbs. When a king sits on his throne to judge, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. Here, the king is God's agent in dispensing earthly justice, making a distinction between the innocent and the guilty, much as the farmer might separate out the wheat from the chaff. Even more emphatic is the following verse. The lips of a king speak as an oracle, and his mouth does not betray justice. Now, the context for this proverb too seems to be the king's role as judge. Behind the earthly king stands all the authority of God. When a king delivers his verdict, it's like a prophet delivering an oracle. In other parts of the Bible, Israel's lack of a king is identified as the reason for the political fragmentation, the violence, and the spiritual drift the nation is experiencing. Reappearing at several junctures in the book of Judges is the biblical writer's judgment that in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And the implication there is that it's the lack of a king that underlies and aggravates Israel's various problems. But running alongside this positive assessment of kingship in Israel is a much bleaker narrative, deeply suspicious about the value of kings and anxious about the threat they pose to the rights of individuals, particularly small landholders. Take this story, for example, again from the book of Judges. It's a parable told by a man named Jotham in response to the people's intention to crown his fratricidal brother, Abimelech, king. Jotham says, One day, the trees went out to anoint a king for themselves. They said to the olive tree, "Be our king." But the olive tree answered, "Should I give up my oil, by which both gods and humans are honored, to hold sway over the trees?" Next, the tree said to the fig tree, "Come and be our king." But the fig tree replied, "Should I give up my fruit, so good and sweet, to hold sway over the trees?" Then the tree said to the vine, "Come and be our king." But the vine answered, "Should I give up my wine, which cheers both gods and humans, to hold sway over the trees?" Finally, all the trees said to the thorn bush, "Come and be our king." The thorn bush said to the trees, "If you really want to anoint me king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon." Well, in this parable, Jotham paints a picture of kingship that he expects will strike a chord among those who are listening to him. According to Jotham, anyone fulfilling a genuinely useful role in society should have too much respect for themselves to leave off the work they're engaged in to take up the dubious task of ruling. Kings tend to promise more than they can deliver. How much shade can a thorn bush deliver anyway? And they're also prone to self-destructive explosions of anger, lighting fires that tend to consume the very people they've sworn to protect. The classic passage warning against the dangers of kings is, of course, the passage that Amy read for us, 1 Samuel 8. The passage is richly ironic, of course, at least to the extent that it's generated in part by Samuel's pique at the Israelites' dismay at his decision to appoint his own corrupt sons to succeed him. Nonetheless, Samuel paints a devastating portrait of what having a king will be like for the Israelites. A king will conscript their sons into his army, swallow up their land, tax and requisition the produce of their land, and finally enslave his own people. Worst of all, in demanding a human king to reign over them, God's people are implicitly, at any rate, rejecting God as their king. And so the picture of kingship as it emerges from the pages of the Old Testament is remarkably nuanced. At their best, kings in the Old Testament can function as God's servants to execute justice on behalf of the oppressed. But the Old Testament is also aware that kings have an innate tendency to degenerate into tyrants, savaging their subjects like wolves let loose in a sheepfold. Perhaps even more bleakly, the Old Testament sees in our desire for strong leaders a self-destructive urge to place ourselves at the mercy of an individual whose own interests are inherently inimical to our own. Time and again, men and women have a tendency to anoint as their leaders the very people most likely to oppress them. So how does Deuteronomy 17 fit into this larger picture? Part 2, kingship in Deuteronomy 17. Well, even at a cursory glance, it's plain that the legislation concerning kings in Deuteronomy 17 has much more in common with 1 Samuel 8 than it does with the more positive assessments of kingship as found in the book of Proverbs, for example. Kingship in Deuteronomy 17 feels very much like a concession that's being made to Israel's desire to ape the nations that surround her, a concession that's then hedged round with so many qualifications, it's arguable that what's left bears relatively little resemblance to kingship as it was actually practiced in the ancient Near East. No harem? No expenditure on costly military hardware? What sort of a king is this? Notice too how emphatically the office of the king is subordinated to the rule of law. Moses paints a picture of a ruler scribe copying out the words of the Deuteronomic law on his accession to the throne and reading it diligently for the duration of his reign. Now, part of me, I confess, finds it kind of shocking that a former French president can be jailed for overspending on an election campaign, or a New South Wales premier can resign having fast-tracked approval for government spending on a sports complex. But there is something nonetheless that's quite biblical about the principle involved in both instances. Clearly, no one should be above the law and its proper functioning. Underlying Moses' stipulations lies a bleak assessment of human nature. Moses expects the Israelites to devalue their unique privilege of having God as their king in their desire to look just the same as everyone else. He expects them to want to return to Egypt, to return to the state of slavery from which they've just emerged. He expects them to abandon their freedom, to raise up for themselves in their king a new pharaoh. Golly, is that what human beings are really like? You may want to ask yourself at this point. Do we really have to fall so unresisting a prey to our most self-destructive urges? And is freedom really so unbearable? And what about our leaders? Is it really only through lack of ability and competence and staying power that most of them fail to turn themselves into demagogues? Part three, Jesus the King. Well, brief though it is, I think you'll agree that the seven verses of Deuteronomy we've been considering this morning raise far-reaching and deeply unsettling questions about human nature, particularly as that nature is illuminated by human leaders and our own attitudes towards the leaders we follow. Kingship, of course, came to Israel relatively late. But when it did, Israel's leaders bore out many of the dangers that Moses' laws were trying to forestall. Think of Solomon and his many wives and the foreign gods whose worship they introduced into Israel. Think of the heavy taxation he imposed on his people and the forced labor he made use of in his many building projects. Think of the personal wealth he accumulated. And Solomon is one of Israel's best kings. But Jesus is the king who provides the kind of leadership which Moses stipulates in Deuteronomy 17, and who shows us a form of kingship that contrasts sharply with a pattern of self-serving, self-regarding leadership that even our best politicians can find themselves falling into. Jesus is the king who impoverishes himself to make his servants rich. Jesus is the king who dies a slave's death to set free a people in bondage to sin. Jesus is the king who does exactly what his father tells him to, who carries out his will perfectly, who sets his face in the direction of Jerusalem, turning away neither to the right nor to the left. Jesus is the king who reigns from the Father's right hand and whose reign will continue long after all earthly rulers have ceased to be remembered. And perhaps most importantly, Jesus is the king whose kingship will never detract from God's kingship, because Jesus is God. But what about us? Well, plainly the kind of self-destructive urges the Israelites experienced, in which they sought to escape from the responsibility God had called them into by redeeming them from their slavery in Egypt, finds many a parallel among us. Because all of us attempted, more or less constantly really, to trade in the freedom we have as God's children for various forms of slavery, be it an addiction, a character flaw of ours which we're just unwilling to confront, or the pursuit of wealth or pleasure. But as Paul reminded his converts in Galatia, it's for freedom that Christ has set us free. God is not content with sullen slaves. He is determined to have for himself free sons and daughters. Many people, I think, worry that if they commit their lives to following Jesus, he's going to take away all their freedoms and their life is just going to be a form of humdrum drudgery. But actually, the opposite is the case. If you commit your life to following Jesus, you'll find yourself cut off from blindly following after whatever it is that the surrounding nations have got. And instead, you'll start to swim against the current. Becoming and being a Christian resembles not so much sinking down into a blissful cocoon of semi-consciousness as it does diving into the Tasman Ocean and picking your way through forests of kelp and hearing the surf pound in your ears. Jesus, as we're about to sing in the words of our next song, came to set the prisoner free, to cancel sin's power over us. Jesus is our Redeemer, our God and King. So let's sing to him now.